Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Author Eke. I'm trying out a new backdrop here, so we'll see how it goes. But I have today Brian Nielsen, and I have to say I have three of his books. So I started at the end, the latest one. Go figure. But so far, it's very interesting, and where it takes place is great. I love the part about the black rhino tusk or ivory. So I like that part. So Brian, go ahead and introduce yourself to the Author Eke audience, and we'll start talking about your books and what else we want to get in our head and talk about.
Yeah, great being here, Travis. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to it. I actually, it's funny you asked about my background. Obviously, a lot of these books deal with technology, where we're going with technology. So, and this is where I think we have a tie-in here. So shortly out of college, I got hired by a company called Electronic Data Systems.
Me too.
And so I moved to Detroit because, as you know, they were owned for a while by General Motors as their big systems integrator. And they gave me a lot of computer programming experience, taught me how to code. And that was what sort of got me interested in thinking about technology, where it's going, what's going to happen next, and thinking about the future. So that's kind of the initial inspiration for these books was, I mean, looking at sort of, you know, when you're doing financial software, it's not as nearly as dramatic. But I was like, well, how might the military use some of these, you know, budding emerging technologies like advanced robotics, nanotechnology, genetic engineering, AI, and sort of merging them together, how might the Department of Defense have used those for different applications? And what's really fascinating about it is there's thousands of applications. So the idea of the first book is that the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. is sort of tasked with getting to the sort of first milestone. Mm-hmm. And it's an arms race between the United States and China as they're trying to be the first one to reach this kind of moment of replication, where you're basically designing these sort of microscopic machines, you're using genetic engineering to let them copy themselves, and then you're using AI to sort of guide them and let them think of themselves.
You wrote that book a few years ago,
right? Yeah, so, yeah. In fact, the idea, and here I'm going to date how long it took me to write. So the initial idea came in the year 2000.
Oh, wow.
The book was published in 2018, but I wrote another book in the meantime, so it wasn't like I was doing only that book. But yeah, it was a long time frame, and started with some ideas that were sort of being floated around in the year 2000 by some of these leaders in technology, and sort of ran with that.
Right. Yeah, what you wrote about in the past is happening right now, where it used to be called, you know, machine learning. They call it AI now, which is machine learning. It's still machine learning. That thing on its own right now. Too much.
Right. Different terms for it. So yeah, in this book, this The Great Unmaking is a little bit more about AI than the previous books. Each one, I try to, you know, sort of teach the reader or sort of, you know, expose them to some different things that are kind of going on. And of course, this one was kind of appropriate because all that's been going on with AI right now. Some of the ideas, you know, when you think about machine learning, you're thinking about the power the technology is going to have. The central metaphor that I kind of came up with is children. Like, how do children learn? How do they adapt? What are the dangers of that, right? So when you have I have a 10-year-old right now, and, you know, he's learning, he's getting smarter every day, but there still be moments like when he's looking at his older brother, says, "I'm going to kill you. I hate you." Right? So there's these things about... There's these things that I was thinking about, you know, we are training AI in a similar way, but what we don't have yet is that sort of... we're not sure it's going to be mature enough to handle the power that it has, right? Which is the way sort of children are. They have these very strong emotions, or they make these decisions, but they don't yet have the maturity and the proper training to know how to handle that. And of course, now that you're dealing with so much power, so much, you know, the ability to manipulate things, deep fakes, you know, these things can get pretty scary pretty fast. When you have an intelligence that's powerful, but not yet wise or really properly educated.
Yeah. When you see some of the things that you're saying it's going to do or can do, and where it's going to really shine, you know, the medical and things like that. It's interesting to see the evolution. I worked at EDS with like really my first job out of the Army when I retired, and I worked in Plano campus.
Okay.
So I worked in the, first I worked in the help desk, and then I went to the engineering group and did consulting for outside customers, and GM was one of our outside customers. So I did go up to Detroit and, you know, spent some time up there in the winter. So go figure.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Probably felt like another deployment. In the winter. Yes. Yeah. Minneapolis somewhere in the winter. That's really cold. So EDS was an interesting company, you know, Ross Perot, and then when the WorldCom merger with Dick Brown, it just went right down. But it was a good company. I see a lot of technology and innovation probably come from that. Especially the financial data card. I remember the data machine. I went and it would spit out the little key punch cards. I was like, wow, this is old technology. And, you know, COBOL at the time, and for COBOL at the time already. So, is your inspiration, does it come from, you know, the news or what you're reading or what you're seeing? Or, you know, a lot of the things in here are happening or could happen that, that's not fiction, but these are fiction books.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get the inspiration behind that? Or you just sit down and go, oh, I got it. Yeah, let's write about it.
A lot of the inspiration comes from the news. You know, I studied like international relations in college. Mm-hmm. So I also try to keep abreast of what's going on politically. So like in the first book, the idea of the arms race between the United States and China was kind of the big kind of central conflict or battle. So that was fun because I didn't know a ton about China, mm-hmm. And the Chinese government when I started that. And I have to admit, there's kind of a moment where you're like, well, do I want to use the Chinese government as kind of the bad guy here? And then you start to do some research. You're like, yes, I definitely do. Because there's a lot of good material here, right? You know, 10,000 Chinese citizens disappear every year, you know, for political reasons. Really got me interested. And yeah. And there's a character who's Tibetan, so that allowed me to sort of explore the occupation of Tibet, the sort of brainwashing, the way the prison systems are used to, to reform political prisoners.
Yep.
The second book actually dives into Chinese activities in China, right? So sort of resource harvesting in China. Yep. In Africa, looking at Africa, how they're sort of set up. This Lao guy. The Lao guy is their sort of prison system, which is essentially every prison in China has a prison name and a factory name. So that they're constantly making products, right? They're making Homer Simpson slippers. They're making, you know, Christmas lights. And U.S. companies or, you know, anyone who wants to do work in China, they kind of, look how cheap these labor prices are in China if I set it up with this factory. And they don't even realize that most of the labor is being done by, you know, political prisoners, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So for the second book, I took that idea and moved it to Africa. So the sort of secret mission that launches that book is to rescue a prisoner who's in one of these labor camps in mm-hmm. Africa.
Yeah, their Belt Road Initiative, right? I mean, they're basically getting all these countries in debt. And they really, you know, their expectations were high, these countries, but a lot have been done in those countries, right? They're not building these railroads. They're not building these roads. They're not building these bridges and whatever. They're just doing enough to be able to get them, entice them, and then get them hooked. And then they're indebted to China.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it's politically motivated. Is it Costa Rica, I think, where they built them a new soccer stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And if they agreed to stop doing any trade with Japan. So like, here's your new soccer stadium, you know, but there's a price, right? There's always a, you know, a hook or a strings attached.
Yeah, I think, China is that they're usually a bad guy, or Russia in my books. right? Because they're, you know, the things they're doing with the green energy and the software that they're building and the way they think they'll be able to manipulate, you know, cars, for example, that, you know, you got a XYZ electric car, the software and hardware made in China. And so when they do a firmware upgrade, the software is already embedded in. So when they do a firmware, it can't be detected, right? Because it's way down at the zero or three level of the kernel or something. And so let's say I'm in California, I got an electric car, fully charged. I want to drive it. And he goes, well, it's Tuesday between at 4 o'clock. You can't drive it.
All right.
It won't go. I want to go 100 miles. Well, you can't go 100 miles. Today, you only go 75. And it could be all based on the credit system, score, focus system, or whatever. But
right,
I think that's something that freaks me out. Are these electric refrigerators that are hooked up to the internet, when it looks like, oh, the temperature inside my refrigerator is 39 degrees, but it's not. Food spoil. And they're buying up all this agricultural land. They're buying up all the meat processors and all this thing. It's all so intertwined, and we're so blinded by greed that we don't even see what's going on.
Mm-hmm,
the potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, they're bad. We pick a good one.
Yeah. And that's, you know, with the military stuff, it's interesting too, because the way that they sort of reverse engineer, you know, stuff that the military makes, you know, everything from advanced, you know, guns and weaponry, helicopters, right? The reverse engineering combined with their sort of, you know, what they can sort of pull from contractors, right? Often U.S. contractors, or they can, the other facet is how they do espionage. Like for China, every Chinese citizen who's in the U.S. or has ties to the U.S. is a potential agent, right? So that you can always be, you know, helping out, helping the cause in whatever field you're in, right? You know, what do you know, or what have you learned about being in the United States that can help us? And that data is taken back and used as intelligence, right?
Yep. I mean, you just see it now that people are, you know, getting arrested or for espionage. You know, Feinstein's driver was a Chinese spy for 25 years. You know, who knows what he came about? It's amazing. Amazing. So, do you write any other type of genre, or are you into the thriller, suspense, espionage type books?
I do like to go across genre. I'm really interested in writing different genres. So these books kind of, kind of loosely fit in the thriller genre, but they're, you know, they're also a little bit of sci-fi even, because they're set a few years in the future, right? So that you have that feel that this is certainly possible, but is just not quite here yet. My first book.
You got to watch out for. You want to put something in technology and they go, that is no way. As when we were watching Star Trek, we're going, they're not going to have any phones in your hand. You know?
Right. Crazy. Exactly.
You gotta be crazy.
Yeah, it's funny. The first book, published in 2018, one of the cool things I put in that was that on video conferences, you could change your background. In the future, you'll be able to change the background to anything you want. And then, you know, when the COVID hit, it got very popular.
You should hit Zoom up with that and told them to pay you the royalties on that.
Yeah. No, it's fun. And it's fun to kind of play around with what's here now and you know, what can it develop into later.
Exactly.
So
what other genres have you written? I've written two suspense thriller espionage type books. And I just got finished with the World War I historical fiction. That'll be out in June or May.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. I bet that was fascinating. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, because I've just recently, last few years, I've been interested in World War I, because I think we're feeling the ramifications of that every day. And the more I dug into it, that's interesting. And I didn't know that in 1918 that we had soldiers in Russia fighting the Russian army 500 miles outside Moscow. And they were from Michigan, the polar bears.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that after the war ended, there was the additional war to kind of get rid of. Yeah. I remember that.
They almost froze to death. Their bullet, their weapons froze and everything. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
I think that's the next one I'm writing about.
Right. That's great. No, that's great. And I imagine that's very interesting to the Middle East too, because that's how the Middle East got kind of carved up the way it is, right?
Yes. That's because that's why they can't get along.
Yeah.
They never were supposed to be able to be in one country, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Private.
Yes. And I recently read a biography of, Lawrence of Arabia.
My dad was in the movie.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, he was one of the foot. When they marched, he was one of the little feet.
No, absolutely fascinating, to look at his life and, you know, what he dreamed of. And then to have the sort of, autonomous states that he wanted just get carved up by the great powers, and how, disgruntled he was and felt like he'd been a failure, really.
Yeah.
So Pillars of the Earth was kind of written tongue in cheek. Like, I didn't really accomplish what I wanted because, they came in and took everything that we'd worked for.
So, yeah. Interesting. Back 1800s, right? When that happened. So it's just fascinating. So what other genre do you like to write?
I'm actually working on a high fantasy book now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so kind of Tolkien, like different races, different, timelines. Very much a midlife crisis kind of book. In the sense that...
Well, you didn't buy a Corvette. So.
That's right, I haven't bought a Corvette. So, the idea is that there's a character. There's been a very bad war. The war is essentially the empire that we're rooting for, the republic that we're rooting for, is lost. Although there is still like guerrilla warfare going on against the empire, but it's just the bad guys are just too powerful and too mighty to be defeated. So there's a character who's basically lost everything. And a group of him and his friends are tried to sort of come together to find a new way to fight the enemy. So it's very much like the second chapter, right? You've gotten some place in your life, you feel like you failed or you haven't gotten to where you wanted to be, and now you've got a few years left, right? You've got like one more chance to try to make something of the life you have. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the central character's problem. What's interesting though about when you're doing fantasy though is you have different lifespans. So some characters, I've got another chance and I've got another chance because I'm going to live for 300 years. So it's no big deal to me. I'll be around. But if you're in this universe, if you're human, then you're really kind of, this is the one last chance I have. So I have to make the best of it. Which is, I think is kind of an interesting thing to play with.
Do you outline your books or do you pencil? How do you write?
I generally can do most of the outlining in my head. I don't actually write out outlines, but I kind of know where I want to get to. Yeah. And so the first book I wrote was nonfiction, and that was about Venezuela and about Hugo Chavez. And I don't know if you remember, back in 2002, Chavez was kicked out of power for like 3 days. And it was kind of a Tahrir Square kind of moment. These people there's a mass protest against him. They marched on his palace. A bunch of people ended up getting shot in the streets. He was kicked out of power. He's arrested. They're about to ship him to Cuba. And then he sort of miraculously came back into power. And that's when he consolidated his rule. From then on out, it was pretty much impossible to get him and his party out. But basically, the book is just those 3 days of the crisis written from the points of view of the people that were there. So my voice actually isn't in the book. It's just the people who were there, the politicians, the people who were injured in the gun battle, the people who lost their children. So it just sort of maps that out in sort of a clocked narrative.
How'd you research that? I would think that kind of a closed country. So how'd you research all that information?
Yeah. So I had a grant to write the book, and then I was lucky because I'd been there in high school for a year. So I knew people that had actually become pro-Chavez and anti-Chavez. And much of the book is sort of alternating between those different perspectives. And so I was lucky that I had quite a few contacts, both in the government and in the opposition, that I could sort of lean on to get those sources.
Interesting. What's the name of the book?
It's called The Silence and the Scorpion. So the silence is actually the area around the palace. It's called El Silencio, the silence. It's the area around the palace where all the violence took place. And then the scorpion is from that a famous fable about the scorpion, the frog. Have you ever heard that? Where the scorpion, the frog went across the river and the scorpion says, "Hey, let me ride on your back. And then when we get across, I'll protect you because I'm a scorpion." And they get halfway across and the scorpion stings the frog. And the frog's like, What did you do that? Why'd you do that? Now we're both going to drown." And he's like, "Well, it's just my nature." So one of Chavez's friends described him.
Waiting on the chicken.
Yeah, across the road. Yeah, that's the river. Yeah. But anyway, so the idea is that this was told to me by one of Chavez's friends from the military academy. He's like, it is his nature to be militant and violent. And so that's what you saw come out on that day. He ordered his National Guard to suppress the march. They shot at them. They killed a bunch of civilians. And that's kind of what the book showed, which the government had been trying to cover up. The government tried to say, "Oh, no, people shot on both sides. It was, you know, we don't know who started it."
Right.
But I was able to prove that the government was the ones who started shooting.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. Mm. And now look at them.
So... Right. Exactly. No, it's a collapsed state. It's a tragedy. Yeah. It's really a tragedy.
Collapsed state.
Yeah.
So yeah. You got these, and this is the same character in all of the books, or same character set in the three books that I have. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Same character sets. Mm-hmm.
Are you going to continue them, or is that three series seven, or you're going to do something else?
Yeah, it's we'll have to see. There's enough loose ends that it can't go on. So the way it ends, it definitely opens up the possibility to keep going. So definitely on purpose. We'll see if Blackstone's going to want to go for another one.
Excellent. And then you're doing a fantasy.
Yeah, right now high fantasy. Right. And I've always been interested in. It's going to be big. Yeah, it's going to be big. Then the world building is going to be the big challenge. It's kind of both ways, because on one hand, you're like, okay, I have to make this own a new universe. But at the same time, it's such a well-known genre that I can write, you know, they were attacked by orcs. And you will immediately have a mental image in your head of that already, thanks to the canon, thanks to Tolkien and all the other movies and Game of Thrones, right? You can already visualize that. So it's a little bit of trying to leverage what I know is already in my readers' heads, but also build a unique kind of ecosystem at the same time.
So why did you start writing? I mean, what prompted you to start writing, I guess, 20 years ago, roughly?
Oh, yeah. So it was while I was at EDS. I was in, Detroit. I was doing pretty well. And I'd always thought about being a writer as a kid, high school. I'd had teachers say, "Hey, you're really good at this, and this is what you should do." And I was like, "That's not practical. Like, you can't make a living being a writer." So I studied economics and international relations in college. And I guess it was, I was about 29. I'd been at EDS, and I'd also worked in finance at another company for a while. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I feel like I can do this. Mm-hmm. So why don't I try to do the thing that I didn't think was plausible, with the idea that, okay, I can always go back to programming. And, if I take up writing and I fail, then I can just go back to some kind of IT job.
Yeah.
And so it worked out. So I went back to grad school. I went to University of Arizona, Tucson. Did a two-year MFA program. Mm-hmm. Right after that, I got the grant to go to Venezuela to write a book, which was a nice kind of punch in the arm, and they gave me the funds. Yeah, so I had basically almost two years to live in Venezuela to write the book. And that kind of got the ball rolling. So, yeah.
How many books have you written altogether?
Four. Yeah. Four? Just this trilogy and the nonfiction book about Chavez.
And that was published through a different publisher than you have right now.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing because the book, the Silence of the Scorpion was published by Nation Books, which is, you know, part of the Nation magazine, which is a pretty far left magazine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it got sort of celebrated by right-wing people.
Okay, so the Economist, the truth,
The Economist loved it because The Economist was like, look, this is what we've been telling you about this guy. Yeah, he's not trustworthy. Yeah. You know, he killed his own people. So the Economist put it on their list of best books of the year. So it's kind of an interesting moment. And then the reason that Nation Books had the money for it was because they had just published a book about Blackwater.
Oh, the security firm.
Yeah. This guy had written this book about Blackwater. Nation Books is a pretty small press. Mm-hmm. And then all that stuff went down about Blackwater and unauthorized killings. So that book took off. And so Nation Books had a bunch of money sitting around and said, mm-hmm. okay, let's do this book about Venezuela.
That's perfect timing.
Yeah. So kind of fortuitous. And it was just kind of strange to me that the sort of the left and right. Because my goal was just to, as I told you, my voice isn't really in the book because, you know, I went there open-minded about, you know, who Chavez was, you know, give him a chance. Right. He's new, you know, he was a dark horse. Nobody knew what he was about. Mm-hmm. You know, and the country had been in a crisis for a decade. So you're like, okay, well maybe a radical change is what's needed. But within a few weeks, I was like, this guy's going to be pretty dangerous. So, but I didn't want to say that because I was like, nobody's going to believe the gringo who, you know, has his opinion about it. So that's why I really wanted to just use the voices of the other Venezuelans. I was like, if I just show the world what I'm seeing here, they're gonna agree, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
So what's your sci-fi gonna be in?
The fantasy book? The fantasy book, I don't know. I'm kind of going a little bit blind on this one. It's very much a project that I want to do personally. I haven't lined up a publisher yet for it. I haven't shopped it yet because I know they're going to want to see the whole thing. So, undetermined how long it's going to be. And again, like you said, this genre tends to be big, like the big books are fat. Yeah. So I think it's probably going to take me at least, maybe 14 months to actually get it done from where I am right now. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I started writing the 104 in November and I finished last month.
That's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I've done 3 books in less than 2 years.
Uh-huh.
But, I was writing halfway through another book, the third series, and I had this idea and I just stopped right in the middle of that book and just started writing this one.
Okay.
And felt compelled to get the story out. It's a pretty good, I think it's pretty good for people that read, the book itself in PDF or form, have really, really enjoyed it. So I'm pretty excited about getting it out and see what folks think about it. But I think it's a pretty interesting story.
Yeah, and that's what you got to go with, right? You got to, if you get the muse and you get the ideas and you're excited about it, that's, you can't wait, right?
Yeah.
That's great.
The toughest part is the marketing aspect of it. Whether you're self-published or through a hybrid or through a traditional publisher, you've still got the author has to build his brand and really market that brand to be able to get the name out. You know, they only need so much from a publisher perspective.
Right. Exactly. So, and publishers want to be doing less and less, right? That's the other thing. They're trying to shift that burden more and more on the authors, which makes, just like you're saying, it has to be now a part of your skill set, right?
Yeah, it's a business. A book is a business. So you've got to have a business plan, which encompasses everything. I've started a couple companies. So, you got to have all that in there about, you know, for the marketing aspect of it, financial aspect of it, you know, everything has to be in there to be successful. Or you could have, you know, the best thing since peanut butter, but if nobody knows about it, then what are you going to do?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, you know, the last Swordmaker, the first book in the series, the one about the China US sort of arms race, that one did not do much out of the gate. But it's actually become quite a solid hit. And I think I have quite a bit to owe from COVID for that. Because it was, you know, it does start off with this idea of programmable viruses. It does involve China, so it hit. I got lucky in that respect, in that, you know, the sales took off in the year 2000, even though it was published in 2018. So it kind of shows that you kind of never know.
A book could come back and published years ago could finally hit its mark. Somebody read something else you'd not written.
Right.
My first two, Blades of Inception and Cobalt, Rise and Fall of the Great Reset, they're more technology, espionage, and I think there's going to be a black car outside of my house. A lot of stuff with surveillance and satellite imagery and all of this and facial recognition and the thing like that. But I find it interesting. But a lot of the stuff, I'll read the paper, I'm going, it's in the book. It's in the books that are written.
Yeah, yeah.
There's one, there's a thing about Sweden, Finland, or somebody is going to jump into Alaska or something for a training exercise, NATO, right? First time ever across the North Pole. And I go, well, I wrote about that in Flames and Deception, but it's the Russians jumping into Alaska. Okay. You know, it's a different, different take on it. But yeah, and I enjoy writing I like to push the technology and then really learn about the technology, because I didn't know much about facial recognition. Then I had to do a lot of studying on that to make how we counter it even feasible or possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I do like learning a lot. And then the historical fiction, I mean, I've read just a ton of stuff, and doing the research is pretty interesting. What you find out when you start reading things, you learn as you write. And that's kind of crazy, right? You've always learned when you read. You're actually learning when you're writing.
Right, yeah. Curious, have you read Fall of Giants by Ken Follett, which is his World War I mega book? That might be good for you. Those are excellent audiobooks, too. They're huge. Like, it's a 40-hour audiobook. Oh, wow. But the guy, his last name is, I think it's just John Lee is his name, super generic name. John Lee, amazing reader for those books. He also did all of the, Pillars of the Earth. It was not what I meant when I said earlier for Lawrence of Arabia. It was Ken Follett, right? Okay. So those are excellent, historic fiction books. Some of the best I've read.
I just signed the audio, deal today for the book.
Great.
So
great.
I'm looking forward to that, because it's basically a soldier's diary found next to him. And it takes a father and son reading it from France to 2 Million Unknown Soldier.
Okay.
It's an interesting book.
Okay. So does it all take place in that time period, or are you moving around?
It first takes place in, goes to 1921, selection of the soldier going to the tomb. Then it goes to 1918. It goes a little bit 1940 because of how the story evolves. And then it goes to present day.
Okay.
And they just read the day-to-day of the soldier and retrace his steps. And it builds the bond that the father and son get by reading it and learning about each other, that things you wouldn't know or wouldn't ask, but comes out by reading the struggles of this unknown soldier. And it builds them, it gets them very, very close at father and son.
Oh, great. Cool. Great.
So one of four.
Oh, so you're committed.
Yeah.
yeah, you're going all in. Okay, great.
Yeah. You got to. All, you know, all or nothing.
So will the other books focus also on World War One, or are you going to be moving around in history?
I think I'm going to do another World War One, then I'm looking at maybe even a World War Two or something. Do I maybe finishing up this third book in the Team Texarkana mm-hmm. series.
Okay.
Which I mean, I got 50,000 words into it and stopped.
Yeah, you're halfway there. Yeah,
I know. Yeah, I could be done in a month or two. You know, maybe three. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I enjoy kind of switching back and forth and everything. So, you got your fantasy book. So, what do you do in your spare time? I mean, you got to have some spare time.
So that's mostly taken up by the 13-year-old and the 10-year-old. I write. I do a little tutoring. I do some teaching. Kind of balance things out. So I have, you know, several what I consider sort of four sort of part-time jobs. It's good. It's good. It's a good balance. I'm feel fortunate that, you know, we have this kind of gig economy that allows me to kind of make money at home and be there, you know, 2:30 when school gets out for the boys. It's working well. That's often a big question, right? How do you support yourself as a writer? How do you sort of make it work? Like marrying someone who works full time is obviously the smartest choice to make. That has paid off for me. So my wife is a professor at the School of Medicine and here in Colorado. University of Colorado. So that's a big help. Yep. But I do have to pull my weight financially too. So
I think I take care of the kids.
It's worked out great. Applying for grants, you know, something that, you know, you try to do as much as you can to bring in a little extra money. If you're doing stuff that's international, like a Fulbright grant, you know, can be sort of spun to do fiction, right? You can do, be funded to do a fiction project overseas, which is pretty cool.
I lived in Germany. I was in the army. I lived in Germany 9 years.
Okay.
Some of the stuff takes place in Germany. Northern Virginia, there's a lot of the intelligence community lives there and everything. This last one takes place in France and the Arlington National Cemetery.
Sounds like awesome. An excuse for a road trip.
I know. Well, my son lives there, so it's pretty easy to go. Well, Brian, I want to thank you very much. And again, folks, check out his books. This is the third one in the series, is The Great Unmasking. And I'm a little bit into it, and I'm really enjoying it. It's very detailed, right? And visual when you read it, which really helps out.
Yeah. I try to push for that cinematographic kind of feel.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and good luck. And, when you get done with that fantasy book, we're going to have them back on here.
Okay, sounds great. Travis, thanks for the time. I really appreciate it. Yeah. And remember those glory days in EDS.
Oh, my. You know what? Man, it was a good place to be.
It was. They gave me a lot of great training. Took care of me. And I it was kind of the basis for a lot of my thinking about technology and science. So
I remember the boss that really guided my career. Then, I mean, I still remember her name, right? And I would do anything in the world for her. She was just an amazing leader. Not a manager. She was a leader. She was amazing. So a lot of the stuff that I think of where I've got to in my career, I kind of owe it to her. Just gave me a chance. I'm playing in the camp. All right, Brian. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Great talking to you. All right. Thanks. Appreciate it. Okay. Bye-bye.